Welcome to PharmaDocs with your hosts, myself, Dr. Jay Resnick, and Dr. John Robertson. Practicing oral surgeons bring you the latest and greatest in pharmacology as it affects you in your daily dental practice.
All right. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
I'm Jay Resnick in Los Angeles, and I'm joined by John Robertson in Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
Hello.
And we are bringing you episode number four, installment number four of PharmaDocs. So...
You know, Jay, I just love doing this because, I mean, just continues to be more and more stuff out there for us to share to our colleagues.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I use it every single day. You use it every single day. And we're out there in the trenches. And all we want to do is make everybody better dentist.
Yeah.
All right.
Exactly.
Bottom line. So let's get it started, Jay. Our first drug is an awesome drug for a condition that we will see in our office quite a lot.
Oh, yeah,
That drug is Fasenra, F-A-S-E-N-R-A.
Yeah, the generic name is benralizumab. So note that suffix, umab or M-A-B. What does that tell us, everybody?
That would be a monoclonal antibody
drug. Okay. Exactly. And this is specifically for eosinophilic asthma.
Correct.
And the way this works is it modifies the activity of eosinophils,
right,
which are a big component in asthma.
Right, Jay, because too many eosinophils will cause airway inflammation. Inflammation now triggers asthma.
Right. It goes through a whole complex pathophysiology, including leukotrienes, mast cells, IgE, eosinophils, and then histamine release, prostaglandins, leukotrienes, and pretty much everything else you can think of.
That's right.
And it can go from mild to severe.
And you know, the great thing about this, Jay, so many people with asthma are on some type of asthmatic drug as well as a rescue inhaler.
Right.
And that's one thing I want to stress to our audience right now. This drug is not a rescue inhaler.
No.
If someone has an acute asthmatic episode in your office, it's albuterol.
Yep.
Jay.
Albuterol. Yeah. Yeah. This is in the category of a control medication. There's control medications and relief medications when we talk about asthmatic medications. And Fasenra is most definitely a control medication, along some of the other control medications that have been around for a long time, like corticosteroids. So prednisone has been a big one, systemic cortisone, as well as some of the inhaled corticosteroids like Qvar, Pulmicort, Flovent. Those have been around a long time.
Speaking about that with the steroids, many patients are on oral steroids because of this, like you just said, prednisone. The great thing about Fasenra, it can reduce, if not stop, your use of oral steroids.
Which
and, you know, there's
fantastic.
So many side effects associated with that.
Yeah. Now, from what I understand, you don't put a patient on Fasenra unless they've been unresponsive or have not responded well to other mainstay asthmatic medication. So it's not your first line drug. Most patients are on, let's say a beta agonist or a bronchodilator, anticholinergic like Cerevent is one that's popular, or Singulair, which is a leukotriene modifier. Those are very common medications that asthmatics, chronic asthmatics or persistent asthmatics are taking. And you can tell how severe the patient's asthma is by how many medications and what medications they're taking. And that's really important for you to, in practice, to understand, is that patients will be coming to your office. And let's say they are on just all they have is a proventil inhaler. And that tells you they don't have very severe asthma. It may just be exercise induced or weather related. But if they're on three or four medications, including an inhaler, then they have much more severe disease. So when patients come to your office, I always tell patients, when a patient comes to their office and says, "I have on their medical history they have asthma," you want to be like a Jewish grandmother, and a Jewish grandmother always answers a question with a question. Like, "How are you, Grandma? How should I be?" So with asthma, you want to dive into the asthma. So tell me about your asthma. What medications are you on? What sets it off? Does it usually get better with, you know, one puff from your inhaler? All these things are we need to know, because we want to risk assess the patients that are coming into our practice, right, who have whatever disease it might be. But asthma is a really big one. In fact, 26 million people in the U.S. suffer from asthma, right, of some severity or another, and about 7 million of them are children. In fact, it is the number one disease of childhood.
Wow. Yeah. You know, Jay, you said something earlier about multiple medications for asthma. One thing I like to talk about when I'm in my lectures on medical emergencies, the Robertson rule of three. Mm-hmm. If you're taking three drugs for one disease state, that's a red flag.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. And that's, you got to dive down deeper. And like you said, the questions you're asking, like, hey, one of the most important questions, when was your last asthmatic attack, right, and what were, yeah, you doing? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I was just walking, or I was going up a flight of stairs, you know. And we also talk about METS, METS, yeah, functional, yeah, METS. That's basically exercise capacity.
Right.
That's what you mean when you ask your patient, can you walk up a flight of stairs?
Exactly.
You're finding out their METS capacity. But if they have stress-induced asthma, mm-hmm, okay, they're coming to our offices. What do? We call
stress them. Right? We cause stress. So, yeah, exactly.
I've been doing this for 24 years, Jay, and every single patient that has asthma, they are told to bring their rescue inhaler.
Yeah.
In my reception, when my nurses call them back,
yeah,
they take two puffs.
Yeah, we have that with all our patients too, especially
never
if they're
had
being
an
sedated.
Asthmatic attack at all.
Yeah.
That's called preventative medicine right there, Jay.
Exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
That's one of those things I say, you can try to prevent a medical, mm-hmm, emergency.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And when you're assessing the severity of your asthma, of the patient's asthma, in addition to the medications, you want to ask them some certain questions that will let you know how fragile they are. So, right, we always ask patients, have you ever gone to the emergency room because of your asthma? When was the last time you went to the emergency room with your asthma? Were you ever kept overnight? Okay. Being kept overnight in the ER for an asthmatic attack is a very significant finding.
Yes.
And have you ever been intubated? And, you know, in med school, I did a number of rotations at Children's Hospital in the just general peds and in the pulmonary department. And, you know, they beat into us, you know, how to assess these asthmatic patients. And asthmatic, when they start out with their wheezing or shortness of breath or chest tightness, at the very beginning, they are able to exchange somewhat fairly well. They can get the oxygen in, force it in, and the CO2 comes off. But as it progresses, and especially if they're not getting any better, what happens is they get what's called a VQ mismatch, which means the ventilation and perfusion of the lungs is not
correct.
It's not symbiotic. So that's you're right. getting perfusion not of blood into areas that aren't getting oxygen, and vice versa. And as this goes on, what happens is the patient's cardiac output has to go up to try to maintain the oxygenation. Their CO2 goes up. They become more acidotic. And one thing we were told to always look out for when we're evaluating our patients in the ER is you may see a patient that's, you know, breathing rapidly with their asthma, trying to get air in and out. And when you see them slowing down, especially, you know, you get a blood gas and their CO2 is high and their O2 is low, you see their breathing slowing down. Does that mean they're getting better? No, it means they're about to crash.
That's right.
And so that's the patient you have to have the tube ready, because these patients may just totally crash on you. So it's a very complicated disease, and it's something that is very, very common.
I mean, we're going to see it almost every day in our offices. Mm-hmm. And I really want to stress to all of our people listening to us and the pharma nation, albuterol is one of the core aid emergency drugs. Yeah. You must have this in your office.
Right. Absolutely.
I know of stories where they did not have that in offices, and things went really bad for the dental office.
Yeah.
There,
yeah.
Right?
I mean,
because of not having a, albuterol inhaler.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. We have, like you mentioned, we have our patients bring their inhaler with them,
yes,
and we also have them in the office.
Right. Now, the other thing about this drug Fasenra. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some other Umabs out there as well too. Nucala, right. Zolair, Dupixent.
I think I've heard that one advertised on TV.
That's right. Well, yeah. The great thing about this new drug, all right, is that the injections are every 8 weeks. So you're only looking at about maybe 8 doses a year. Mm-hmm. Whereas yeah. like with the Nucala is 13, Zolair can be 13 to 26.
Oh, wow.
Dupixent is 26 doses. Okay. But
so every 2 weeks.
You said something great. You said, you know, the step care therapy for asthma, the great thing about it, just like we talked about last time with the migraines, there's mm-hmm. getting to be more and more drugs out there that are available for people who are refractory to other
right.
drugs.
Exactly. All right? As we learn more and more about these diseases.
So there's help out there. Just like with Alzheimer's, there's more stuff coming. So that's a beautiful thing. So yeah. let's move on to our second drug.
Okay.
Besremi.
Besremi. And the generic name of that is, are you ready for this? Ropeg interferon alpha 2B NJFT.
Just love it. I just say good old interferon right there.
Okay? Besremi. Let's call it
so
Besremi.
So what's that used to treat, Jay?
That is used to treat polycythemia vera, which is technically it's a blood cancer. It's an basically a mutation that at least in 90-95% of patients, it's a mutation that results in overproduction of red blood cells in the bone marrow and also white blood cells and platelets. And what it does is it makes the blood very thick and sticky.
Not
exactly.
Good.
And
that
so
the word sticky is not a good thing.
No, you don't want to have sticky blood. And so this this is a pretty serious disorder, and it can progress to myelofibrosis, myelodysplastic syndrome, or AML, acute myelogenous leukemia. And because it can progress to all those things, the mean survival of polycythemia vera is a little less than 11 years. So this is a serious diagnosis, and as we get medications that are better at treating this, we're going to see our patients living healthier lives and living longer and coming into our practices that have had this disorder for, you know, 10, 15 years, hopefully. And they're still going.
And the risk for PV increases if you're a male or and you're 50 years or older.
Yeah, yeah, okay? Yeah. You're higher risk if you're 50 or if you've had thrombotic events in the past.
There's a lot of signs and symptoms with this, Jay, like chest pain, like, I mean, a lot of similar stuff that we would see with a myocardial infarction.
Exactly.
But the biggest concern is, like you said, thick, sticky blood. So everybody out there, what is that concern about? Blood clots.
Yeah.
All right. So exactly. That means your patient's at risk for throwing a DVT or a PE.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that could occur in your office. All right.
Exactly.
At any given time, you know?
Yeah. And you know, patients with polycythemia, it can be due to other diseases too. It can be a secondary polycythemia, let's say from being at high altitude increases your red blood cell count. Or it could be if you've got some liver disease that increases your amount of erythropoietin, that's going to cause you to produce more red blood cells. But those are known as secondary. So primary polycythemia vera is, like I said, 90% or more of cases due to a mutation. And what gene is it a mutation of, Dr. Robertson?
That gene mutation, you have...
We've talked about it before. What's yes. that gene? Name that gene. It is the Janus kinase JAK2 enzyme.
Oh, Janus
system.
Kinase. How could I forget that? I think yeah. didn't you say that was a drink of something?
No, there's a mutual fund, Janus Funds. Yeah. So, you know, this is going to be a serious disorder. And the way they diagnose this generally is from a high hematocrit, a high hemoglobin. So
that's
hematocrit
right.
over 50 or a hemoglobin over 60, 16 rather. It's a little lower if you're talking about females. But they go by that. They go by a peripheral blood smear where they see yes. blast cells, or sometimes a bone marrow biopsy where there's megakaryocytes increase in number. So all those go to the diagnosis of polycythemia vera. And so this, you know, this drug hopefully will be some new hope for patients that have polycythemia to be able to live longer, more productive lives. But
so, Jay, I mean, when you were trying to say polycythemia vera, all right, now the patient comes in on the health history, they're going to write two letters, P EV. And a V. All right.
Which if you live in LA means what? You live in Palos Verdes?
Right. Well, the thing about it might have the tendency not to really ask more about it, but like I talk in my lectures about IE. A patient came into a dental office and she had the two little letters.
Infective endocarditis.
Yeah, that's right. Infective endocarditis. And the hygienist went ahead and cleaned her teeth. A couple of days later, she was in the hospital with endocarditis.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got a PICC line. And didn't turn out too good for the dentist and the hygienist.
No. So if you, again, it's like the Jewish grandmother. If you see something on the patient's medical history and you don't know what that abbreviation stands for.
Right. And so many people abbreviate things.
Look at it. Yeah. Patients will abbreviate. Look it up. You know, it's better to, you know, you can ask the patient, but you'll look, be a lot more impressive to the patient if you've looked it up already on Medscape or Hippocrates or on your computer. And you know what it is before you go in and see the patient.
Okay. So, or your assistant goes in and sees the patient beforehand, just like we talked about knowing your pharmacology. Okay.
Yeah.
You want to sound good to your patients and then have your assistants go in there and look up if there's any abbreviations, i.e. Ma'am or sir, could you tell me what it? Oh yes. Infective art. And then write it out and give it to your dentist. That's how you solve that. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you always want to be as informed as you can. Now, this drug, as wonderful as it sounds, has a lot of serious side effects. It is not a drug to be taken lightly. It can have all kinds of side effects that could be lethal. It can affect your heart, cause cardiomyopathy. It can cause MI. It can cause AFib. In addition to being very toxic to the liver, it has pulmonary toxicity. It can cause pancreatitis. It can cause colitis, which could be ulcerative colitis or ischemic colitis, which could kill you. You can have hypersensitivity reactions to it too. It's a very serious drug. So there are a lot of patients who can't take Bezremi, even though they would be good candidates for it otherwise. And so that includes anyone let's say that has high blood pressure or has pre-existing cardiac conditions. And another one is that Bezremi can actually seriously affect the neuropsychiatric system. And so patients can become suicidal taking this medication. So you've got to be really careful if you're prescribing this for a patient, that you make sure that they don't have any suicidal tendencies or attempts in the past. And if you're a dentist seeing this patient, you want to basically make sure that this patient does not have some of those side effects, because let's say they have an adverse effect from the treatment that you do and they're on Bezremi that affects gives them suicidal ideations because of their them not being happy with your treatment. So these are all you don't want to think about all these things, but there are so many things that go on with our patients and in our patients' heads that we've got to be aware of all these things. As we're not just tooth carpenters, as you know, we are clinicians of the mouth, and we've got to know not just what goes on in the oral cavity, but what's going on in the rest of our patient.
Oral health equals great overall health.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
You know, Jay, some of the drug interactions are concerning here too, because drugs that are metabolized basically as a CYP450 substrate, they can have significant
interactions with Bezremi.
Yes.
And so
like amiodarone, cyclosporine, some of the myelosuppressive drugs.
Yeah.
And now we won't be writing those, but narcotics, hypnotics, or sedatives.
We're going to be sedating our patients and giving pain medication.
Overdosage due to this. Okay.
Exactly.
So you got to be careful with those people on Bezremi. All right. Whether on narcotics or sedatives, be very careful, very dose dependent. That's correct.
Yeah.
All right. And Jay, also with Bezremi, as you can imagine with PV, what really does apply to us, you can have significant tooth and gingival issues as well, too.
It's generally due to xerostomia. It gives them a really dry mouth, and that can lead to periodontal problems. It can lead to increased caries rate, and it does the same number on skin. It can be toxic to the skin, where the patient gets xerodermia and rashes and itching, right. Just like it affects the oral cavity. So this is a drug we really, as dentists, you know, we're not going to be prescribing it, but we really need to be aware of it because, our patients are going to have a higher incidence of xerostomia and caries and periodontal disease, but also if we're going to prescribe them pain medications or sedatives, we've got to know the side effects of this drug and how serious it is.
So that wraps us up. And now we're going to finish our last little segment on NSAIDs, okay?
Yeah.
Year before last, we had 93,000 people, Jay, die of opioids. I just got the latest numbers. You probably read it too.
Mm-hmm.
100,000.
Yeah.
So things are not getting any better.
No, the opioid crisis is not getting better.
Right. And so we all write narcotics, but we can scale back. And I have scaled back. I know you have. And many of our listeners have done that as well, too.
Yeah.
So let's just end the show here talking about a great acute pain management regimen. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And it really depends on, you know, how much pain you expect the patients to have is going to determine what you're going to advise to the patient for taking for post-op analgesia.
Well, so we'll have a mild, a moderate, and a severe anticipated post-procedural pain category. Okay.
Exactly.
And I really like what Hirsch and Moore did in their study, Jay. And we talked about it last time about the 58,000 sets of wisdom teeth that were removed. And mm-hmm. they did ibuprofen.
Is that in your office last year?
Last month.
Yeah. Oh, last month. You've been busy.
Yeah. I barely made it to the show.
Yeah. All right.
So they did 600 milligram ibuprofen, 1,000 milligrams of ibuprofen, did it for 3 days. No narcotics were used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I mean, that is my routine in my office is, I used to give, Vicodin or Lortab or similar medications postoperatively all the time, especially after wisdom teeth. And I've gotten in the habit now, everybody does 2 extra strength Tylenol and 2 ibuprofen. Together
before they get to your office or after?
Not if they're doing sedation. If they're doing a local, I tell them to take 2 ibuprofen before they come in, about an hour before. But if they're doing sedation, they get IV fentanyl, at least in our office. And then we try to get them, of course, they have local, which lasts for an hour or so. So by the time they get home, they're going to get something in their stomach and they're going to get the Tylenol and ibuprofen into their system. And, if that doesn't cut it, then I tell them you can go up in the first 48 hours to 3 ibuprofen or even 4 and still be pretty safe. And then my backup drug that I always use is especially for wisdom teeth. And I usually it's more significant procedures like impacted wisdom teeth or big implant cases where I will give them tramadol rather as a backup. Trazodone would be nice too. Tramadol is a backup. And I tell them, take that not instead of the ibuprofen Tylenol combination, but as a supplement too, if you need it, take 1 or maybe 2. And most patients I found really don't need it. I always give them, just to be safe, a refill so I don't get called at night or weekends. And it's pretty rare that patients refill it. Most of them have at least half the prescription left. Or even more of it when they come back for their 1 week follow-up.
So, Jay, the one thing about what they did in the study, it wound up being a fixed interval dosage. Mm-hmm. Okay. Not just 3 times a day, but every 6 hours for 24 hours.
Exactly.
So that means you had to set the clock. And one thing I like to do for my patients on their first day, on the back of my postoperative booklet, I write down the entire first day schedule, when to take the medicines.
Yeah, we have it in our post-op instructions too.
Right. I'm a big fan of Marcaine. All right. So I use Marcaine on all my surgeries. Mm. And so I tell them about the 3-hour mark after leaving my office, that's when I want you to take a half a tablet of your pain medicine.
Yeah.
I do write hydrocodone. I only write 5 milligram. I tell them to take half, Jay.
The 5, 325.
Write 5 pills. That's right.
Yeah.
No. All right. So we've already cut the Tylenol in half. So in case they need more Tylenol, I'm safe. I'm under the therapeutic index. Yeah. But whether it be mild to moderate, which is around 400 to 600 milligram fixed for the first 24 hours, every 6 hours, then they move to ibuprofen 400 milligram as needed. All right.
Yep.
Then if you move to moderate to severe, same thing, Jay, 400 to 600 milligrams ibuprofen plus 500 milligrams acetaminophen.
Right.
Every 6 hours for 24 hours. So around the clock. Then you did that same dosage as needed every 6 hours afterwards.
Yeah. As needed. All right. Yeah.
Right.
And then the studies have shown that, I mean, there was just an article in the ADA not too long ago, but also in the orthopedic literature and in the emergency medicine literature, that the combination of 1,000 milligrams of acetaminophen with 400 milligrams of ibuprofen is actually superior to hydrocodone acetaminophen combinations.
Right.
So that's really powerful information.
Right. Well, and that's what that study was done with those wisdom teeth, 400 milligrams ibuprofen and 1,000 milligrams. So, and then if we get into the severe, you would do the same thing as the moderate, except they recommend hydrocodone 10 milligram, which I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, I never do
that. I would either add a tramadol, like you said, or I do a 5 milligram, only five, broken in half of hydrocodone.
Yeah.
So they're only getting 2.5 milligrams for the first 24 hours.
And remember, with tramadol, we talked about this warning a couple episodes ago, is that one of the way that tramadol works is by elevating serotonin levels. So if you have got a patient who's taking a medication that increases serotonin level, like an SSRI antidepressant or a tricyclic antidepressant, you've got to be really careful about giving them tramadol, because it can put them into that serotonin syndrome that we talked about, which can be severe. I mean, it's treatable, but of course you don't want to, you don't want your patient having to go to the emergency room because of the, you know, tachycardia and high blood pressure and headaches. Right. And you want, so you want to make sure that if you're going to prescribe tramadol, that you make sure, that's again why looking at their medical history is so important, that they are not taking SSRIs or tricyclics or any other medication that increases serotonin level.
But you know, Jay, bottom line, when we meet those patients for the first time, you need to go ahead and set the stage. I'm not this kind of dentist that's going to write a lot of narcotics. I need you to understand that. We're going to treat your pain with drugs that really, we're not going to mask your pain.
Right.
We're going to treat that. And also, I'm a big fan of Decadron as well too. I love steroids. Great anti-inflammatory. All that working together. As I've told our guests before, I'm a huge fan of Toradol. I give IV Toradol. And I love.
Yeah, that's a great drug too. We do that in recovery sometimes too.
Yeah, and then I send them home on Toradol, and then when they wake up the next day, it's Toradol and 1,000 milligrams of acetaminophen in the morning. 12 hours later, same thing.
Yeah.
They're off the narcotic. Done.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing about non-steroidals is that they attack the cause of the pain, which is inflammation, whereas a narcotic just masks the pain.
All right. So Jay, that wraps up our show.
I guess so. We've been talking for almost a half hour here.
And it just seems like we just started, and I just love giving this information to everybody. And I just hope everybody finds it useful and helpful, and you can go out every day in your practice and apply it.
Yeah.
And, when's our next talk, Jay?
Oh, actually, wait a minute. We have someone who wants to ask a question.
Okay.
We have a comment here. And the comment is, let's see. I see a, oh, I'm sorry. It was a thumbs up, not a comment. Silly me.
We thank you for the thumbs up.
Yeah, thank you for the thumbs up.
Any way we can make it better, let us know.
And we will be back again on December 23rd. So again, the second and fourth Thursdays of the month at 5 p.m.
That'll be the Christmas edition.
5 p.m. on the West Coast. It'll be our pre-Christmas Eve installment. So we'll have to have maybe some cookies here and milk and hot chocolate, maybe a little schnapps or something to get in the spirit.
I think we should wear our Christmas hats. How's that sound?
Okay. All right. That sounds good. So we will see you all in in 2 weeks, December 23rd at 5 p.m. on the West Coast, 8 p.m. on the East Coast. And until then, stay safe and stay sane.
Thank you.